Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Welcome everybody, or welcome back, because there's still some stragglers who we haven't seen since before the lockdown, I think. But we're back in our stride and having these public events. People tend to see CMC as very kind of bookish, and a public event here is a few elderly professors peering at a manuscript. But actually, we do try to be more kind of inclusive of the wider community, and the tale of the great outdoors is probably symbolically the best way of getting away from the books, I think. Mm-hmm. A welcome change. So, alhamdulillah, Paul is a familiar figure of CMC since his shahada, and you had your wedding here as well, I think.
Indeed,
upstairs,
yes.
The nikah, yes, so happy memories. Paul is also a person who has a very interesting and, I think, to many of us, relatable life story. It's not the kind of standard story of how I found the truth of Islam, but it's a series of reflections on the nature of modernity, the understanding that we have or don't have of gender, masculinity, and also it's almost like two stories that interweave towards the end, the story of your personal struggles with self and God and truth, but also the story of these rather harrowing marathon experiences that you had. And it's very interesting to see how the two stories kind of converge towards the resolution at the end of the book. But what I'd like to do, if I may, is if I could invite you to read a paragraph which reflects your experience of all of these marathons that you ran across the Sahara Desert in Morocco. Okay, it's a very beautiful passage.
Thank you. Assalamu alaikum, everybody. This is from the introduction to the book. The sun began its descent behind the high dunes of Erg Mazil. I hauled myself to my feet, reshouldered the burden of my heavy pack, which contained all I needed to survive this week, and left checkpoint 3. One of my bivouac mates, a serving soldier, army commando, and veteran of the notoriously tough P Company selection, had been forced to pull out at the second of today's mandatory checkpoints. The skin on his left foot was macerated and was separating from the flesh. His injuries were the result of 3 days and around 130 kilometers of running, walking, and occasionally crawling over dunes, dry wadi beds, and salt flats, in temperatures in excess of 40 degrees centigrade. This was the Western Sahara in all its savage glory. It made no sense that I was still there, me, the 58 kilogram school teacher. The last few days had been among the toughest of my life, and the thought of a further 100 kilometers was hard to contemplate. I was nauseous, my head pounded, every square inch of my body ached, and then, at the midpoint of the brutal 71 kilometer overnight stage of the Marathon des Sables, I began the ascent into Erg Mazil. The sky darkened, revealing the myriad desert stars. Soon I would be blind to their beauty in more ways than one. The light wind blurring the perfect crests of these Lawrence of Arabia dunes hardly hinted at the hellish assault on mind, body, and spirit that the night would bring. For years, my heavy heart had pined for adventure. Soon I would be truly tested, forced to operate at the very limits of my endurance, from moment to agonizing moment, hour after glorious hour.
Thanks. I found that a very beautifully written passage, actually. The book has some considerable literary merit. Could you explain, perhaps, for those of us who are not familiar with the marathon world, exactly what a marathon is and what an ultra-marathon is?
Yeah. Marathon, standard marathon distance is 26 miles. Anything, it's really considered an ultra if it's over 50 miles. So anything beyond 50 miles, usually there are ultras that are 50, 100 miles is quite common. Even anything up to 400 miles is not unheard of. And often the ultra marathons tend to be in more demanding environments.
And you can go as slow as you like?
There's usually a cutoff. There's either it will be a in the Marathon des Sables. It's if you're if you're caught up by the camel, yeah, there's someone walks behind the course with leading a camel, and if the camel catches up with you, you're out. That's it.
So, but there must be lots of other rules. How much are you allowed to carry? Do you have to provide your own tent, sleeping bag, food?
It varies. It varies. The Marathon des Sables is what they call a stage race. So there are compulsory overnight stops on that. So you have to stop overnight, and you share, they say a tent, but it's really just a Hessian kind of cover from the sun and the worst of the wind. In terms of what you have to carry, there is a mandatory kit list, but there's much toing and froing on the website in the run up to the event, with kind of people exchanging ideas about how you can reduce the weight in that pack to the absolute minimum, cutting toothbrushes and sawing toothbrushes in half, and cutting the corners of foil food packets to take just a little. You know, and it does actually make a difference over the course of a week if you're something on your back, especially when you're my size, because in the end it was, you know, for a great big man it's no big deal, but I was carrying almost a third of my body weight at the beginning of the race, you know, which was no fun.
And a lot of it is quite high tech nowadays, so presumably if you've got a big budget, you're at an advantage. How did you cope if you were a school teacher on a shoestring?
I had a family. Wasn't earning a huge amount of money, so I had to be quite creative, especially in the Yukon race, because you were dealing with temperatures as low as minus 40.
In the Canadian Arctic.
Exactly, up in the northwest Canada, and the kit there is the kit list is quite rigorous, and they check it, you know, to me, because it's life threatening otherwise, and you know, like there's a, you know, people have had life changing frostbite injuries in that race, many people actually, so they're quite strict about the kit list on that particular race, but you know, if you've got, as you say, if you've got an unlimited budget, you can buy a minus 50 rated sleeping bag, but I wasn't in that position, so I had to cobble something together, and you know,
whatever was available at the local camping store.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
but army surplus.
Yeah, but I mean, you must at times have wondered whether you were literally going to make it, because I noticed it was actually in the headline, somebody from the Marathon des Sables last year actually died during the race. Yeah. I think a cardiac arrest or something. Yeah. A young guy. It is. It's on the edge, isn't it?
Yeah. There were a number of occasions. In the overnight stage of the desert race, the year prior to the year that I took part, the race organizer, Patrick Bauer, a Frenchman, was criticised in some regions of the press for having allowed his race to become too easy. So he must have taken that to heart, because there's always what he terms the dunes day, which is kind of rich because there are dunes every single day on the race. But he calls it the dunes day because it deals with the high dunes, as we just heard. And there's also the overnight stage, which is 50 miles. And the year I did it, in response to these criticisms, he decided to drop the dunes stage right in the middle of the overnight stage. And these are dunes that were like hundreds of feet high. And the weather the year I did it was appalling. It was like the sandstorms from start to finish. In the middle of that that long stage, the overnight stage, I really thought I wasn't going to make it. But there was no way, as luck would have it actually, there was no way to call an end to it anyway, because the helicopter wasn't flying because of the storm. So there was no choice. I had to just keep going, you know.
Yeah, that's one of the most terrifying passages. And I have to confess, when I read that, I was kind of asking, why? Why do people do it? These sort of extremely painful and dangerous and presumably quite expensive sporting events. Yeah. Some people are doing it for charity, and you can understand that. But they, a lot of these competitors seem to be just proving themselves to themselves, to the army. What drives them?
Yeah, it's interesting because it throws people together in this really intense experience. And so you end up, you find yourself, I found myself on many occasions in conversation with people. And people have often, very, very often, and have very interesting stories and very interesting reasons why they find themselves in that particular situation. I don't think anybody wakes up in the morning and says, I think I'll go and run 130 miles across the Sahara Desert. You know, people tend to have a compelling reason for being there. And there's always a backstory, you know. And as I say, there seems to, the shared experience seems to bring about an unusual level of trust, and people share more of themselves than you would normally expect of people who've only just met, you know. So it's, but there's often a very interesting backstory.
So you don't just retreat into yourself and nurse your injuries. You're on the lookout for other runners.
There's a lot of injury nursing going on, people do tend to. And there's an interesting thing happened in that desert race, and that when the storms really blew up, and that. There's this they call it drafting, whereby like they do in the Tour de France on the cycles, but the same sort of thing but on foot, and that somebody takes the lead and takes the worst of the impact of the wind and the sand, and then people run behind that person, and then when the one at the front's had enough, as much as they can take, they peel off to the back and so on. So there's a real kind of shared. People do support one another, you know, and are encouraged to do so.
I want to read a brief section from your description of the Yukon Marathon, which, since I would rather be warm than cold most of the time, sounded like actually a more drastic and soul-sapping experience than those sort of 40-plus temperatures in the Sahara.
You know, and more dangerous, objectively more dangerous.
I leave checkpoint 2 just as dawn is tugging at the blanket of darkness. Apparently during the same dark, troubled night I'd spent battling with myself in this terrible, beautiful place, the Yukon sky had been lit up with a spectacular display of the northern lights. So you missed them.
I missed them, okay.
It feels symbolic of something that I missed them. All beauty or semblance of pleasure is now lost on me. It just hurts all the time. I root around in my waist pouch for anti-inflammatories. I find one and a bit. I swallow them and plow on. My hydration bladder is still frozen solid. No great surprise as it's below minus 30 now. There's no doubt about it, this place could kill you. Ice is crystallizing on my beard, mustache and eyebrows, and even on my eyelashes. As I struggle forward, the pain builds again and I sink into a dark mental pit. My weakened, vulnerable state invites a vicious and familiar little troll onto my shoulder. He assails me with every painful event he can conjure from my past. Every hurt, every betrayal, every humiliation is played out in my mind in glorious technicolor. Every emotional wound, whatever the stage of healing, is worried open again, and the troll sits there laughing. The pain in my hip jolts me back to the moment and I trudge miserably on. So we meet this troll several times and it seems to be part of your own personal kind of inward wrestling with yourself. But it sounds here as if the race has made the troll stronger rather than strengthened you against the troll. So this book is not a straightforward account of how you master yourself and therefore achieve nirvana of some kind. It's much more ambiguous than that, isn't it?
Yeah, and I don't think that journey for anybody is ever straightforward. It's I mean, I think it's often a series of highs and lows, and what I needed to arrive at eventually was some sort of middle way, and but for I think they're both the highs and the lows were both part of the same thing. That needed, I mean, I'd found myself, because of the way I'd lived when I was young, I'd found myself, I'd lived a life when I was a young man that was excessive in many ways. And the consequence for me of that was an inflation of the ego. The nafs was in control of me, you know. And I think that's why I found myself. I stopped drinking alcohol, for example, when I was 25 years old. I knew that there was going to be no progress in my life spiritually as long as that was part of my life. That had to go if any progress was going to be made. But that was just the beginning of a long journey thereafter. And that kind of inflated ego, it needed something really big to break it or to start to break it down. And I think that's why I was drawn to these extreme events. It seemed to like the it's almost like there's the tyranny of the nafs could only be broken by a kind of another kind of tyranny, the absolute absorption in the physically, emotionally, mentally, in the activity. It brings you right into the moment because there's nowhere else to go.
So was it a form of escape? What are you saying? You're running, but you're running away from your issues.
I think that was perhaps the intention, but it's not really what happened because what you're left with is yourself. There's nowhere else to go. It strips away all the nonsense, all the ideas about who I think I am, who I want other people to believe I am, and you're left with the truth in some sense, you know, and it just seems to be something that I needed to clear away, to get rid of some of the noise, and I think the fact that these events take place in nature, in very beautiful places, I think is part of that as well. It's part of the picture.
So there's quite a lot in the book about the yearning for the primordial, for a sense that modern life has alienated us, that it's a search also for the meaning of your masculinity, desire for initiation, all of those very archaic things, kind of shamanic things that you feel modernity has banished us from. So is that why many people go into sporting events, would you say, because they're trying to return to a more physical experience of themselves and getting away from the screens and the cars?
I think perhaps that's the case, but I don't know how conscious people are that's what they're yearning for. I think I was quite blessed in that, because of the path that my life had taken, the place that drinking alcohol had taken me to, then the people that I met subsequent to that, and finding myself in with groups of men talking about this idea of masculine initiation, which is something that has existed in primitive, inverted commas, societies forever, and which has been largely lost. And I mean, the mechanisms for taking boys on that psychological journey from boy psychology to man psychology, the mechanisms had been there, but in the West have been largely lost. And and you know, there's that wonderful African proverb that if we don't initiate the boys, they'll burn down the village just to feel the warmth. It's a responsibility we have to bring boys to. I mean, I'm speaking as a man, so I speak. I mean, I'm sure there's a corresponding process for women, but I'm not qualified to tell that story. But yeah, we've largely lost that in the West. But I was in with men who were talking about it and who recognised that it was missing, and I was guided towards. It was one of the things. I mean, and it was part of my searching for some kind of truth, something that was real. I found myself in a situation, I'm going to touch on it briefly in the book, where I went out and took part in a modern day masculine initiatory process, and it was great. It did me a lot of good. It moved me a little further along the path, you know.
Traditionally, initiation would be an initiation into the transcendent secrets of the tribe.
Yeah.
But do these modern men's retreats have any kind of spiritual concreteness about them?
They follow the same trajectory as initiations. It's one of the fascinating things about these processes is that they all follow the same format, no matter where in the world they take place. They all tend to happen at around the same age, around that kind of 13, they're about 12, 13. But they follow that kind of classic hero's journey arc, where there's a descent. The boy is removed, sometimes forcibly, from the kind of the domain of the feminine, because up until that age they've largely lived with amongst women, and they're forcibly in traditional societies they're often forcibly removed from that. Then there's a kind of descent, and then there's usually some sort of ordeal that has to be taken on. And then there is this idea that the sacred knowledge of the tribe is passed on, and then there's the return with a new responsibility in the community. So there is an awareness of that in these modern day approaches. They're not outwardly spiritual as such, but there is an awareness, and a lot of people, I think a lot of men who are drawn to them are on some sort of spiritual search and find their way subsequently, you know.
But they must be quite unsatisfied if there isn't something really concrete at the end of it, because initiation is about unveiling the true meaning of things,
yeah.
And beginning a specific incantation or prayer or rite that has been handed down by the ancestors, but it's hard to imagine how these slightly new age men's retreats can really supply that.
I think what happened, I can only really speak for what happened for me, and I think what it did for me was like it opened that wound on some level and kind of cleaned it out and sewed it back together again so it could begin to heal. But there was work to be done, but it was a stepping stone for me to something more real. Yeah.
Because it revealed to you what you needed, or because it satisfied a need?
I felt more like an adult. I felt like a man for the first time in my life, even though I did that when I was, what age would I be? In my early 30s. I still felt very much like a boy, I think, you know, and I think the modern world does that. It infantilizes people, and it dangles all the trinkets, and you know, it tries to convince us that we can purchase peace of mind, we can purchase safety, we can purchase security, and pleasure and all the rest of it, and you build this castle, of this fortress of stuff around you. But I think the reality is that you can never build that wall high enough anyway, and it becomes less, well, for me, it became less of a fortress and more of a prison. So I think that that kind of infantilization is part of that. So you know, keep the little boy entertained, you know. And I had to move beyond that to make more. Like, first I had to get rid of the mind altering substances, you know, and then I had to approach life more as a man than as a boy. Yep.
I mean, Jung has this phrase, pure eternus, the eternal boy, which is how he characterises modern adults, that they never really experience initiation into the mysteries. Exactly. They don't grow into their gender and its significance, so they're always kids looking for treats.
Yeah. And Robert Bly, he followed on that exact point, and with his book, The Sibling Society, which again says that there are no adults. You know, we're all trying to initiate other boys, and this is why I think this is at the heart of the problems that we're having with gang culture, like little boys psychologically, little boys trying to initiate other little boys. You know?
All of these mall murders in the US, which is usually disturbed young men.
It's lack of initiation,
incel movements, and it seems to be becoming worse.
Absence of adult men.
Yeah. But one of the stages that you passed through, and you talk about it in the book, was your tribulation with alcohol. And I know you have a new book about Muslims and alcohol. Would you be prepared to explain to people who maybe have never touched a drop what it is that is appealing about it and how one can leave it behind?
It's a whole. What I tried to do with that book, which is called Hope for the Muslim Alcoholic, 12 Step Recovery in the Light of Islam, is to take. I mean, it's a difficult one. Alcohol is haram, and it's haram for good reason. It's a mercy. It's a protection against the forgetfulness of Allah that comes about when people drink alcohol.
Is that the main reason for its prohibition? As somebody who's been through that tunnel, how would you describe the essence of the experience?
It's a curious thing, and it's a very difficult thing to explain. But I think for me, I can only speak for myself. It was the antidote to fear. I was a very, very fearful child. I was frightened of everything.
This is the troll prison.
Yeah, exactly. I was very fearful. And the first time I grew up in Scotland, and Scotland has a very unhealthy relationship with alcohol. I don't know why, but it's always been that way. And I suspect, sadly, it always will. But for me, it was about fear. And the first time I drank alcohol, all of a sudden, that fear was gone. And that was a very, very attractive thing for somebody who'd always felt afraid.
Dutch courage before you go over the top in the trenches.
Well, for me, it was like it felt like I'd been born. Like 3 or 4 drinks short of normal, you know. So it was, rather than Dutch courage, it was like it enabled me to be like I perceived everybody else to be. I thought, oh, this is what it feels like to be normal. I mean, it's a delusion, and it's a lie, but it's a very seductive lie when you feel so frightened all the time. As a consequence of that, I did it again as often as I could. Drank as much as I could, as often as I could after that. But I mean, obviously not very much at that age because I didn't have any money. But as soon as I did have money, you know, when I was 16, I was drinking very regularly.
Yeah.
And it was, but I think fundamentally it's about fear.
Yeah, I mean, when I was a teenager, I would go out drinking sometimes with friends, but my experience was rather different. I did it generally to be one of the boys, to have enough pints in the pub to keep up with everybody else. But I remember once vomiting in a ditch outside this country pub and thinking, this is actually quite horrible. It's like being seasick and you can't quite balance and the world is going around and you want to vomit, and thinking, is this actually worth it? So I never really was kind of seduced into the heart of the thing.
I think there's a fundamental difference between someone who drinks excessively because they've decided they're going to drink excessively and get drunk or whatever, and somebody who has that addiction, if you like. Something different happens. The phenomenon, I think the average drinker, even if they drink too much, doesn't experience the phenomenon of craving. Once alcohol goes into the system, it seems to be processed somehow differently by certain individuals. And I think I was probably one of those individuals. And what happens is, once alcohol goes into your system, I lost the power to decide how much I was going to drink. And also, I lost power over how I behaved, really. And that's why it brought me, a blessing that it brought me to my knees very young. I stopped drinking when I was 25 years old. Because I just knew that. In fact, I feel blessed that I was brought up in a religious context. It's not a context ultimately that worked for me, but it was a religious context. So I had a sense that the life I was living, there was a gulf had developed between the life I was living and the life I felt I should be living, and it became intolerable to me. By the age of 25, and to the extent where I thought,
yeah, no. So you had the strength to snap out of it.
Well, I think I wouldn't say I had the strength. I think I have a real sense that
you were pulled out of it. Yeah.
Picked up and pulled out of it. You know.
Yeah. So if somebody is watching this at some point and they're personally struggling with alcohol or some other addiction, is there a word of advice that you would offer?
I think seek help, and don't allow shame to get in the way of seeking that help, because it's unlikely, if you've crossed that line or if you're one of those individuals that I've described, for whom it's different once alcohol enters the system, you're not going to be able to sort it out yourself. It's unlikely you're going to be able to sort it out yourself. Seek the help that's there. And that's what that recent book is all about. It's about those touch points between the 12-step approach to recovery and Islamic teaching. I've tried to show that these are compatible. This is not something for some other group of people. It's there and it's legitimate and compatible with your Islam.
It can be tough for young people in Muslim communities to admit that they have these issues and to go to community elders, to parents, to imams, who will just kind of box their ears and tell them to sort themselves out. So would you recommend they go to some counsellor or professional therapist? What should they do?
If that person has crossed that line, it's, you know, you often hear, I mean, it's become almost part of common parlance, this phrase, rock bottom. And people tend to have the picture of rock bottom as the street drunk lying in the doorway, you know, and et cetera, et cetera. But it doesn't have to be like that. The lift, you can get off that lift at any floor. You don't have to go to the basement, you know. So I would say that if drinking, I mean, alcohol is haram, but if there's no use just telling somebody it's haram. It's if they're struggling with that, as an addiction. It's if it's become intolerable to you, if it's costing the person more than money, then seek help. And I think the 12-step fellowships are a good place to go, because it is a spiritual program, and people, a Muslim mm-hmm. who is struggling with alcohol would find familiarity there, I believe.
Yeah, so you'd recommend something like Alcoholics Anonymous for Muslims?
The 12-step programs, yeah, okay. Yeah, I think. And mm-hmm. there is, I believe there's an organisation called Milati Islami in the United States. Mm-hmm. It's not made its way to the UK yet. I don't know much about them, but it's a 12-step fellowship with a specifically Islamic focus.
Okay, worth looking into. Mm-hmm. There's one interesting moment that you describe when you're going through your phase of having a relationship with alcohol, where you're on a cold day, pub crawling, I guess, in Edinburgh, and then you see somebody who's doing something rather different. Do you want to summarise that?
It was a pivotal moment for me. I didn't realise that for many, many years. But I mean, I must have been in my early 20s. And I think pub crawl even makes it sound rather more glamorous than it was, to be honest with you. I was alone, you know, and I was just wandering from pub to pub, and I was drunk. And it was early evening, Maghrib time, I realise now. And I was walking along George Street in Edinburgh, past one of the big churches. And the church was closed. And I was standing at a bus stop. I smoked at the time, so I was standing smoking a cigarette at the bus stop. And there was a man had rolled out his prayer mat. And I mean, I knew enough to know that this was a Muslim, but beyond that, I knew nothing, you know. But I watched this man. I was standing there. I was lost, completely lost, directionless, you know. And ironically, this man, I remember him looking at his compass. And so he had direction, but He laid out his prayer mat, and he put his shoes to one side, and he prayed. And I can remember just being really struck by the contrast. I was living this chaotic life at the time, directionless, kind of hopeless. And here was this man who seemed to me to be somehow touching paradise, you know. And it just really struck me, you know. There was something really struck me in that moment. And I wanted to speak to this man when he finished his prayer, but I was just too ashamed, you know. And I just, he went on his way and rolled up his prayer mat and went on his way, and I wandered off back up the street into some dingy little pub somewhere, you know. But it stayed with me. It never really left me. That, and it mm-hmm. took a long, long time. Yep. I was a bit of a slow burner, as you know. It took a long, long time, mm-hmm. But eventually, I was guided towards the truth. You know.
Do you want to say something about that sort of the happy ending? Although, somebody once said to a new Muslim, you have won the battle, now you must fight it.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the beginning of something new. But all of these things, the extreme sports, the experience of alcohol, issues with masculinity, all of these things, they're kind of all symmetrically. Do you see it as providential that you're slowly being nudged?
Now, when I look at my life, I think it was all leading towards Islam. It makes perfect sense now to me.
But a hard road.
Yeah. But it was for me. It had to be that way because I was so, like I say, the nafs that had become so inflated that it had to be that way, and there had to be the level of pain, if you like, and both in terms of just the way I was living and the way it felt. But also consciously going out there and doing these, these things that are spoken about in the book, seem to, like I say, to quieten all that noise and allow something else to bubble up to the surface, to make my vision a little clearer, I think. I do feel it was all providential and guiding me towards something. Yeah.
And you're now in a little cottage in the Scottish borders with a Muslim wife. And,
yes,
alhamdulillah, looking back on this.
Assalamu alaikum. I just wanted to ask you, in terms of your experiences, especially with the marathons, how did that create the intimacy that you wanted with God? Because I guess the book itself is talking about God in these kind of situations and places. And how did you, going through all those moments, help create that intimacy? And also, how would you recommend to someone who, inshallah, will never do a marathon in their life, how to kind of recreate or experience something like that as well?
That's a really nice question. I like that question. I think it's very insightful that you've used the word intimacy, because that's certainly how it felt to me. And there's a little episode in the book which took place in the middle of the Marathon des Sables, which is a 130-mile ultra in the desert, Moroccan desert. And I found myself, for the first time during the race, I'd stopped. They give you what they call a road book, which is a kind of strange name for it, because there aren't any roads anywhere in the whole race. It's just salt flats and sand dunes. But they give you this road book, which has, it has compass bearings and terrain information and distances and everything on it. And I'd stopped to check. I was with this guy from this ex-parachute regiment guy. We'd been covering ground together, and I'd stopped to look at the road book, and when I looked up, he was gone. He was like 300-400 meters ahead of me, and it was an assault flat, so it was absolutely dead flat, except for this. It was like, those old John Ford movies in Utah and Arizona, where you get those mountains, like the one in Close Encounters. There was this completely flat apart from that, off in the distance, and I was completely on my own, and it was totally silent, and I became aware I was in floods of tears, and I didn't really understand it, but looking back, and I now see that it was just like, it's that, this idea, the primordial revelation, God in nature, and just being there. It wasn't an intellectual process. It was a totally overwhelming emotional experience, spiritual experience. So, and that, and intimacy is a beautiful word to describe how that felt. And with regard to the second part of your question, I don't think it has to be 130 miles in the Sahara Desert. I think just nature, it's there, it's beautiful. And for me, even as a child, when I was up in the Highlands in Scotland, I knew, I kind of felt it. I could feel that the truth of it all, I didn't understand it. I couldn't articulate it. But I think just being in those places, and especially if one can be in those places consciously, with intention, I think that's what I would endeavour to do.
It's just a comment rather than a question. And perhaps, I don't know if you agree with that concept of understanding from the same principle as to why people do the extreme sort of 100 miles, 400 miles marathon runs. Would you say it's it works in a way to improve your soul, to improve yourself, your nafs? Mm. Is that perhaps at the end of running such a marathon, would you say, I've turned myself into a way that it's easier for me now to, let's say, maybe do Qiyam al-Layl or pray at night or wake up very early because now I have control over myself. Perhaps there is this, I'm sure all of us know it, قَدْ أَفْلَحَ مَنْ زَكَّاهَا, as in, after in one of the chapters of in Quran, Surah al-Shams, after many very strong and scary oath of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, at the end of that oath, there is وَنَفْسٍ وَمَا سَوَاهَا أَلْهَمَهَا فُجُورَهَا وَتَقْوَاهَا, as in talking about the self itself. Could that be part of أَفْلَحَ مَنْ زَكَّاهَا, as in you tame yourself in sort of spiritual way and also perhaps physical way? And by the end of that activity, physical activity, you're stronger, you can live longer, worship better, and so on. Does that make sense? Or
no, I think, sorry, I think, for the long I think I understand. I think I understand what you're saying. And I think the... When I first signed up to do one of these events, I knew. I mean, I'd never done any sport at all. I wasn't unfit, but I wasn't fit. And I knew that I thought, if I've got any hope of completing this, this is going to take discipline. I'm going to have to get up early in the morning in the middle of winter and get out there and run with a pack on my back and with ankle weights on and with hand weights, and I'm going to have to, in a heavily weighted pack, I'm going to have to go out there and I'm going to have to do it, and I'm going to have to ignore the blisters, and I'm going to have to ignore the shin splints, and I'm going to have to ignore the pain and just do it, right? So discipline, yes, absolutely. But also I think what it does is that getting up early on these races, even while the race, while out on the races, getting out there, doing that stuff, returns you to actually a much more natural way of being. I mean, if you think, we evolved to follow the prey beasts and the way the crops as they emerge. We had to move around. We were constantly on the move. So human beings are meant to be on the move. So I think it also returns you to a more natural human way of being, in a sense, you know? It felt like that way to me anyway.
Hi there, thank you. I was just wondering about all the things that you've suffered and everything you've been through and the things that you've learned. Have you come away with some thoughts and advice for young lads growing up in the world today, anything that you would love to share with them?
I'm increasingly, thank you for it, for the question. I think it's a really important one. You know, I've been thinking a lot recently about the responsibility that as a man, most my responsibility in that situation. And I think men need to step up more than ever they have done and help young men to make that journey. I think it's we can't just say over to you, you know, sort yourself out. I as an adult male have a responsibility to step up and make that transition from boy to man easier for the young men, because it's getting harder all the time to make that journey. You know, it's the modern world is actively working against boys making that journey. It wants them to stay young. There's so many distractions and so many temptations that weren't there even when I was young. You know, I suppose it's about what I try to do. Is, I mean, there are a number of young men, like sons of friends, sons of family members, and I just try and be there and listen to them and not necessarily advise, but I just try and speak from experience, the experience that I've had, and hopefully if it's done with the right intention, it'll be useful. But I suppose the point I'm making is we can't just lay it on the boys. The adult men need to step up to the responsibility and help them.
I was wondering, in the course of writing the book, whether you're influenced by similar literature, and specifically I was thinking about the Japanese novelist Haruki Murakami, who wrote a book, What I Talk About When I Talk About Running.
I've not read that book. I'm aware of it, but I've not read it. There were certainly books that I'd read because the other thing about people that take part in those kind of events is they tend to be a bit obsessive, right? So, you know, it was like read every book about ultramarathon running that exists, and every recommendation about kit and just everything. So I did read a lot of stuff at that time. I didn't read that though, but yeah, it's useful. But a lot of the time, I don't know about how he approaches the subject in that book, but
it's because it's autobiographical, right? And about running, so it's a similar methodology, if you like.
What I found in the stuff that I was reading is that spiritual element was absent. A lot of men being men, a lot of it was about kit, a lot of it was about, you know, diet and, you know, training runs and preparation and all that. So it tended to be a bit technical. So for me, the stuff that I was reading didn't have that. There's something missing for me. But yeah, does that answer your question?
Yes. Yeah.
Thank you.
I'm about to run the half marathon in March, which is a drop compared to what you've been through. But for me, as a very inexperienced runner, and someone who finds this really daunting, one thing that I do when I'm running, and I ran just before this, and it was really tough, and mentally I get that troll as well. When my body, if I feel a very big mind and body separation, and I feel as though I can't, I'm out of control. I want to stop. You know, I want to stop. But one thing that keeps me going is having a mantra or a word or a prayer. And when I was little, my dad taught me to breathe out "Hu" and say "Him" as I was like doing something hard. And that's what I do now when I'm running. And I've met other people who, you know, and I've now met other runners. I still don't feel a part of the running crew, but I've met other people who have other mantras, and not of a spiritual kind. And I wanted to ask you if you had a particular prayer or word or a mantra that you kept as you did that.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because I didn't think anybody else did that. But you have to bear in mind that I wasn't Muslim when I approached these events. I genuinely feel that these were part of my journey to Islam, but I felt that I just, because I growing up I wasn't the sporty one, like that my brothers were the sporty ones, you know. I was the kind of quiet, bookish kind of one, you know. But and I just didn't feel like I belonged. It's like I didn't feel like I had a right to be doing these events, right? I thought I was kidding myself on. I said, "Who do you think you are, signing up for this?" You know. But I used to, when I started running in preparation for the desert race, it was horrible. I hated it. I used to live in Willesden Green in London, and my first training runs were to Queen's Park, which is only about a mile away from Willesden High Road, you know. So I used to run there and run back, and it nearly killed me. I hated it. And I just felt awful. I just thought, what have I done? You know, I've signed up for this. It's 130 miles in the Sahara Desert and I can't run to Queen's Park. And it was awful. But then I started to get stronger, you know. I used to run past, there was a newly built, at that time, newly built gym. And I'd be shuffling along with my heavy pack and my ankle weights and my hand weights. And I would watch the people through the window of the gym watching the TV with headphones on, running on treadmills. And I thought, that's not the way to do it. This is the way to do it, you know. And then I started to, the mantra that, it's silly, but the mantra I used to chant to myself, MDS, Marathon du Sable, MDS, 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 just to really kind of, to distract myself from how painful it was for a start, but just to keep me focused on the task at hand. So yes, I did have a mantra of sorts, but there wasn't too much kind of spiritual intent behind it at that time.
Assalamu alaikum, sir. My name is Suleiman. It's nice to be here. Just wanted to firstly say thank you for being very open and vulnerable about your story. In your talk, you mentioned the importance of role models. So I wanted to ask, who are some exemplary men that you've met in your life, and what specifically is it about them that you admire? Thank you.
Wow. Without wishing to embarrass the Sheikh, there's one of them sitting right beside me. I took my shahada with the Sheikh Abdul Hakim about 7 years ago now. Yeah, but I met Sheikh Abdul Hakim many years before that. Many years. It took me a long, long time to make my decision. I first met you about 18 years ago. It's incredible, isn't it? The kindness that you showed me, the one thing I remember vividly, I think it was the first meeting with you here in Cambridge, in your office at the university, and you said something which really struck me, and you know, because I was saying I need guidance, and you said, I can't remember the exact words, but you said something like, I'm not sure I can guide you, but I can be your friend. And that really, really struck me. It stayed with me until to today, and it was, and I think it was just that that kindness. I thought this is Islam, and I want to be part of this. I want this, you know. And we spoke many times subsequently, and it's not the appropriate place to go into it, but the circumstances of my life at the time made it very difficult for me to come to Islam, but it never went away, and the fact that someone so busy would make time for me was very, very powerful for me. So, Sheikh Abdul Hakim, certainly, yeah.
Regard me as a sporting icon.
And I suppose my very, very first experience of Islam was, I think, and I really see this as a privilege now. I went on a Saturday night to Cricklewood Mosque, and Sheikh Ahmed Babakir was there, and it was during Ramadan, and the Hajra was in full swing, and I just thought, what is this? And I was completely mesmerised, and another wonderful man who gave me a great deal of time, and I spent a lot of time in his company along at the Islamia school, which was just along from where I lived. And so these are two very important figures in my life.
I suspect that there's a lot more questions, and I think people are really benefiting, really grateful for your frankness. It's a book in which you know, talk quite a bit about some of the harder things in your life, and I think a lot of people will be really profoundly influenced by that. What's the next book? Is there a sneak preview?
The hope for the Muslim alcoholic is that's just been published in Kindle and Kobo and Apple store, but it's coming out in paperback soon. I don't know when, but soon. It's only a little book, but I really hope inshallah it'll be a useful little offering. Otherwise, I don't know. I'm going to have to contemplate and to think what's next. One of my things that I do is storytelling, I've put together some little collections of traditional stories as well, Scottish stories and Irish stories, and so maybe hope to do something with that.
Wonderful. Look forward to that. So sorry, we're out of time, but there is an opportunity to mingle now. There'll be juice and nibbles outside, and I think we've still got some more copies of your book. If you'd be happy to sign some further ones, they're on sale for £5, I think. Okay, but thank you very much.
Barakallahu fiik. Thank you.